The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
Welcome to Getting Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard. With me today is Neil Stevenson, who is our very first guest on our very first episode of Getting to Yes And. Neil has worked with IDEO, the design firm that is very well known around the country. He has run a fashion magazine. He went to Oxford. He has an accent. All that. And what I want to talk about with you, Neil, today. So I just got back from doing a TEDx in Colorado Springs. And the subject was something that you and I have talked about a little bit before. It's an idea around strategic discomfort. And what I was talking about there was an idea that developed to me over my time at Second City, which is that I think one of the biggest barriers to innovation and creativity is actually past success. You have a tendency to repeat yourself a lot. You have a tendency to stay in the same kind of patterns. And I talked about this with the audience and a bunch of academics, and we talked afterwards, and there generally was a lot of interest in this idea, but also a bit of confusion, because I was talking about things like failure and mistakes and challenges, and I was talking about them positively. And that was not the orientation I was getting back from most of the people in the audience. Is this something you've encountered in your work?
Yeah, I mean, I love being uncomfortable. I feel very uncomfortable right now, actually.
It's working.
Yeah, so I this is a really misunderstood concept, though, because a lot of people, there's been a lot of fetishization of failure lately. It's like, oh, we've got to embrace failure. And it's like, well, just failing all the time is not great.
Probably not.
That, for me, was much of the 90s. But the thing about discomfort, I got into working at this creative company, IDEO, and I mistakenly thought that being creative was loads of fun. And I thought, this is going to be a great career. And I found that every single project, if it ever involved coming up with something new or having a new idea, you went through this period of acute misery because you were lost. And it was almost to get to something new, your mental model of how a thing was previously had to be broken, and that was always uncomfortable.
Right.
And it's come to this point where you think, like, well, actually, it might be impossible to have a genuine creative new idea without first having some discomfort. But that's not how it's PR'd, is it?
People
sort of say, like, you see creatives on TV, and they're always, like, hammering away on computers looking really exultant and happy, but
yeah,
actually it's miserable.
Yeah, no, and agreed. And you see, so one of the things I talked about was the fact that I wrote a book called Yes And, which is about how we take our improv principles into business. And I'm going to say any author who says they don't do what I'm about to say I did is lying to you. Because when I was on book tour, I would always go into the bookstore in the city I was in to see if my book was on the shelf. So, and I was looking at all these business books, and indeed, they have these books about failing and risk, and that they give you no practice in it. And I think the thing that I discovered over time at my time at Second City is that actually the process by which we create review comedy at Second City bakes in tons and weeks of failure. And it's not just that you have sort of time to fail. We also give you sort of behaviors that you can use to fail quickly, to fail together, to fail fast. This is the stuff that you do to get to all the really good stuff, because I will tell you, no great idea, no great comedy scene at Second City came out fully baked. The very best stuff really sucked when it started. That's been my experience.
Yeah, and I think it's difficult because people always want to reduce something to just one word, so it's like a really big word on the cover of the book. I mean, it's like, yeah, you fail, and then what do you do with that? You learn about how you failed, and then you do the thing again in a slightly more evolved way. I think that was the big learning for me about creativity. It was this one word, but actually was a process of all these different mindsets you have to go through. And then, yeah, the thing that people often wouldn't understand is one of those mindsets was this thing you're talking about, this sense of acute discomfort. I've been looking up more about it, actually, and there was a Swiss child psychologist, Piaget, if you're into child psychology, he's
love
the guy.
It.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he had a theory called disequilibrium, which basically says that when you have a mental model shift, you are out of balance for a period. So if you're a small child being taught the word cow by your parents, and you think like, okay, well, a cow is a black and white thing with four legs and it goes moo, and then your parents point out a brown cow, you're like, that's not a cow, that's not black and white. And then they insist that it is, and it, provided you accept their word, you have to actually break your old mental model of black and white and four legs and modify it. And as you go through that period of breaking it, that's what he called disequilibrium. You're in this period of you actually feel worse before you feel better. And that writ large is what you're going through when you go through that failure moment in an improv scene or something like that, or when you're trying to design a product, when you go through that thing where your conception of what the thing's going to be is about to get bigger, but before it gets bigger, the previous small conception has to break.
To out-nerd you, there is a professor at NYU, Adam Alter, who talks about cognitive disfluence. Yeah. And what Alter is really talking about is this idea of breaking pattern, right? And this is a lot, we talk a lot about this podcast about improvisation, and more so than we talk about comedy, but one of the things about most comedy is that it is a pattern interrupted. You know, it's an expectation that's not to come or something different happens. That's a lot of what that is. And I want to talk to you a bit about sort of designing discomfort, you know, because I think that that's something, it's what improvisation does by the virtue of putting six people in a room and saying there's no script, you have to make it up. So there, and then there's some rules around it. What I've discovered in my time with you is that you tend to design uncomfortable experiences for yourself in some sort of like, I don't know if it's a journey for something or a midlife crisis or all of the above, but I'll set you up for the story, which was Neil and I, one of the things I do often is take him to spots around the city that I've known because I've lived here all my life. And so I took him to Jim's in Maxwell Street, for any of you who have been there or not been there. It's a great old place. They had to move off of the traditional Maxwell Street area when that got changed. It's right up against the highway, and we got pork chop sandwiches. The bone is in the pork chop still when you eat it. It's not necessarily a safe place to be. And we're sort of eating out there with the cars, and you almost died eating pepper.
Yeah, it was. it's not that feeling when your teeth go through the soft bun and meet the hard bone. It was quite alarming. But yeah, but more the way you'd sort of set up, you're like, let's go to this place. It's terrible and disgusting. You'll love it.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that.
Yeah, that was an accurate setup. And then we're driving away, and we passed Au Chevelle, which I've never been to, and you had. And you were talking about how good it was. And I go, okay, Neil, would you rather go back to Jim's or go back to Au Chevelle? And that's when you sort of like launched into this like story about your college reunion.
Oh, okay. I did wonder where you were going with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. So I think what's been going on for me is I've had a few experiences in life where, like you say, discomfort. When I look back on it, the discomfort has proved to be valuable either for creative purposes or for experiential. It leads to some kind of story. And yet, at the same time, I'm an incredibly lazy and cowardly person. And so, in the moment, I will choose the easy option always. And so I found myself locked in battle with my future self, trying to engineer these situations where my future self has to have some miserable. So when I was younger, I always used to hitchhike everywhere because you'd always end up having some kind of terrible adventure that was miserable. But afterwards, you'd be like, that was great.
I survived.
And so this one, I a couple of months ago, I had to go back to Oxford for a college reunion. And my experience of college was always that of doing uncomfortable, stupid things. And I think I felt like there'd be something sad about going back as a middle-aged man and sipping sherry and sort of, so forth. And so my parents live about 10 or 15 miles away from Oxford, and they had an old fixed gear bike in their shed. And so I said, I know what I'll do. I'll I'll go to this reunion, but I'll go on this fixed gear bike so that at the end of the night I have to bike home through the unlit country lanes of England and I'll just see what happens.
Okay.
Thereby setting up a situation where, you know, even if I wanted to get an Uber home or whatever, I couldn't because I had this stupid bike. So, yeah, so sure enough, I got incredibly drunk because of nostalgia and fell off the bike and then got lost. And then the lights failed and I got more lost and it was miserable but kind of amazing. And after about 3 or 4 hours when I finally got home with blood and brass and stuff all over me, I felt that somehow I'd recaptured some element of my lost youth and that had been a wonderful thing. And I could never have engineered that situation at the moment, but by this act of sort of forward-looking self-sabotage, I'd made something happen.
Yeah, so let's unpack this. Because you are decidedly not setting yourself up for success. However, you are setting yourself up for story. Because the fact is, like, who wants to hear a story where, like, everything works out? Like, no one wants that. I want a fiasco. and you create fiasco for yourself.
Yeah, and it was great. It was memorable. And God, I'm trying to justify it now.
Please do.
It was somehow the experience of being at college was of a constant sort of roiling fiasco. And I felt like I'd authentically re-experienced it. I think that I had this morbid fear that it would be this sort of what you think a college reunion will be, a sort of, sort of checking people out for weight gain and baldness and trying to find out how much money people are making. And it's just horrible. But instead, I'd managed to re-experience the true essence of college, which is of, you know, falling over, hurting yourself, and not knowing where you are.
You also, before we drop this subject, but you had a famous dorm room at Oxford, didn't you?
Yes, I had the same. Well, this is a deep cut. First,
let's go.
Oxford
going deep
movie back. Fans. So, anybody who's watched the 1986 Rob Lowe movie Oxford Blues?
Has anyone seen that?
Oh, that's an amazing movie.
Yeah, look.
Really?
Yes.
God, I didn't think. Okay, so Rob Lowe is this sort of terrible idiot who, in the movie, I mean, in real life, obviously, he's
lovely man,
a living god, but in the movie, he goes to Oxford and he takes up rowing and he. Lives in this room that is filled with old boats and old oars and so forth. And you think they built it for the set, but it's actually real. And that was my room at Oxford. And I was into rowing in those days.
Yeah, you're in the Rob Lowe room.
Yeah, the Rob
Lowe. Now known as the Rob Lowe room. So I think about this stuff in terms of sort of designing fiascos. And the thing that I always find fascinating is how the people at Second City, who founded Second City, so it opened in 1959, seem to have like understood this stuff at sort of a basic sort of gut level. So when you're creating a show at Second City, it's like a 12-week process, and you use these late-night improv sets to experiment with like dangerous stuff. And you do that in a way that is not going to hopefully get a shutdown, because a lot of weird stuff has happened late at night. So I was thinking about this, and I don't know if I've told you the story or not, but I produced a show in 1995 that ended up becoming Pinata Full of Bees. It was a very celebrated review that kind of put Second City back on the artistic map. But the process was like really rough because they were trying to experiment so much. So one night in the improv set, they had this idea. And they were doing a scene on the stage, and they had one of their actors interrupt the action and say, "Hey, everybody, I'm sorry to say this, but President Clinton has just been shot. So we're going to bring out a TV. Anyone who wants to stay, you can watch with us. Other people who want to leave, go." And there's all these people murmuring, and almost everyone stays. And then they bring out a TV. The whole cast comes out. They put on the TV, but what's on the TV are sports bloopers. And then the cast just watches the sports bloopers until every audience member left. In the words of Rachel Dratch afterwards, you could hear a mouse shit. I have never received so many angry phone calls the next day. I'm just feeling people that go, "That was irresponsible." I'm like, "I know it was. I am so sorry."
And how did this lead to a wonderful creative epiphany?
So what happened was, it did. Now I'm justifying. What happened was the cast realized that they wanted to turn on the audience, but they couldn't make the audience turn on them. So instead, what they ended up doing was planting one of our actors in the audience before the show started. So John Glazer, every night, would show up, buy his ticket to the box office. I mean, he was like deep cover, like anyone cared. He would order like nachos, he'd eat them, he's on his phone. And then for the opening sketch, they called him up as an audience member, and he ended up fighting the cast as Uncle Sam and declaring America is... I mean, he's kind of predating Trump. He was making America great again. And that became a way of the audience immediately knowing, like, okay, they're going to play with us in a different way, but they experimented on one of their own at first. So it kind of opened the door for that.
That's so cool. Yeah, so that's a classic example where when they then win some kind of comedy award and get interviewed on a show like this, they might look back and say, well, there was clearly we had a clear insight that we needed this interaction with the audience and so forth. And people will post-justify things, make themselves feel,
yes,
seem really clever and like it was always going to work. But in your story, actually, they got there just by dicking around.
Yes.
And also doing stuff that was uncomfortable. And I think it's a great example.
So one of the things we were talking about backstage is, you know, we Neil working at IDEO, me at Second City, we have lots of theories about the way things work as it relates to sort of creativity and innovation. But I think the thing that we're talking about is fiercely useful in the world we're living in right now. And as I was putting together this TEDx and realized I was talking about the idea of upsetting patterns for yourself and the idea that past success can actually, you know, be bad for you, a line I came up with was, it's my absolute belief that all of us in this country right now believe so strongly in our own point of view that it's killing us.
Yeah, or that it's become very comfortable to have that point of view. You're now like kind of, I hate those people, and everyone in my Facebook newsfeed agrees with me. So
right, and the
good. Yeah.
Right, and then this is the latest one, is the celebrating of blocking people. You know, where it's like, well, I block them, you know, whatever. And I'm like, great, you've just basically said this human being is no longer worth it. That's what you said.
I feel bad about blocking you now, Curly.
You should. That's what this was about.
It's just all those pictures of your dog.
Yeah, I know. But this idea of like putting this out into the world, which is, you know, are there ways that we can break this habit of repeating our own success? Is there a way we can design situations so that we are actually putting ourselves in a little bit of risk, but in a way that can, you know, not kill us, but get us to something new?
Yeah, and I actually... I was making a joke about it before, but I actually do like the setting a contract with your future self. I mean, after meeting you, I signed up for improv classes. And, you know, just the word improv makes my hands prickle with sweat.
Yeah.
But, you know, having paid my $300-whatever, thanks for the no discount. But
it's not true. He was comped.
I had to go, and, you know, every single experience of it was I would go there filled with a cold, clammy dread. And then afterwards, I'd feel like I'd done a really good thing. And then every week, I'd still the dread thing. But by having sort of signed up for it and set that contract, I had to do it. And I think this notion of putting yourself in situations where in some way you've made a commitment where it's more awkward to back out of it, or you're letting people down, the social
right.
pressure to back out of it, it's much harder to sort of leap into the unknown of discomfort in the moment. It's much easier to sort of set yourself up for things where you have to do it later on.
So after you did the improv classes, then you took this like a step further.
What are we talking about?
You went and did stand-up.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was another example. So I said I was going to do stand-up, and I found a very nice, talented comedian, Adam Burke, who took me along to a couple of open mics. And as soon as I got to the open mic, I realized I'd made a terrible mistake and I had to leave immediately because, mm-hmm. you know, all these people were half my age and I was not funny and oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. But Adam was there and he'd come with me. And so, again, the social pressure was there. I had to go up and do it. And so it was...
And it went okay?
Yeah, the first time went surprisingly great.
How'd the second time go?
Terrible. And that was my big lesson with stand-up. I just said exactly the same words in the same way with the same inflection. And the first time, people found it hilarious. And the second time, it was like I was reading a train timetable. So I learned a valuable lesson about stand-up, which is it's not just you being funny. It's a relationship with an audience.
Right.
Harder than I thought.
Is there been a third?
No, I failed. I'm never going there again.
But you did improv. You did stand-up. Have they, like, did you go, like, parachuting? And what is there another... like uncomfortable thing that you've designed for yourself?
Yeah, I do want to do stand-up more. I think stand-up is actually, just in that brief experience of it and learning from people, I think it's one of the most incredible sort of arts of communication that there are, and I'm just still plucking the courage up. Actually, I need someone to come with me. Maybe you could come along and just stand by the door and refuse to let me leave.
It's funny. Well, you know, because I did not really study improvisation before I worked at Second City. And I remember one night out when we had the old Second City Northwest in the suburbs, Nia Vardalos was in the cast of My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And she's like, "You're doing the improv set." And it was one of these things, like, no one had ever said that to me. And I'm like, okay. And I was terrified. But the minute I got a laugh, it was an incredible experience. I'm like, all right. And that wasn't great by any stretch. But just having put myself out with that, I can't believe the kind of high I had driving home was unbelievable.
Yeah. And, you know, there are no great highs without the discomfort. I think that's the thing, that nothing comes for free. You know, you have to be able to walk towards that horrible, scary thing in order to get that feeling afterwards, which is kind of annoying. But
Yeah. Okay. So when we close the podcast, we always ask for a yes and story, and I'm putting you a bit on the spot here, because you know you've done this before. You gave me a great yes and story last time you were on the podcast, which involved you doing drunken bass playing.
Okay.
Right, remember that? So the question is, and this idea in improvisation is that when you're groups of people making something out of nothing, you can't say no, and you can't stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Is there something that you can think of now that is a yes and moment from even, like, it could be this week, something you did, or it could be something that would happen last month, it could be at work, it could be at home with your kid?
So somewhere where I've encountered a situation and sort of gone with it.
Yeah.
I once found a packet of drugs in the back seat of a taxi in Miami.
And?
I snorted them. It was... Just to be clear, it was...
What do you mean, just to be clear?
It was a really bad idea.
Okay.
I was in Miami.
Well, you're saying that so you're not recommending it to the kids.
Absolutely not.
Because my daughter is here in the audience.
Okay. Okay, let's just do this in layers. Well, first of all, I don't recommend that generally.
Okay.
But if you're going to do it, I thought, well, it's Miami. I've seen Miami Vice.
I've heard
this cocaine thing, and I thought it was going to feel highly confident and assertive for a while. It turned out to be ketamine, which is a very sort of dissociative anesthetic they used to give to animals. And
what happened?
Most things, yeah. I felt like I was falling, but in all directions simultaneously, and it went on for about 4 hours. Yeah.
Well, kids. Neil Stephenson, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down.
Okay.